boot on the ground. I ain't going to be part of your system. That's a lonely island. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Jays threw everything on the ground yesterday against Brian Bayo as he mowed them down. 9 strikeouts and 11 ground ball outs over 8 shutout innings. I could have, of course, also gone with double literally run New York, but that wouldn't make much sense without the context that I was in New York the last few days. Thank you to Sho and Nick for doing the show over those 3 days. Would have preferred if you didn't destroy the TV studio that we're normally in. I don't know what happened there, but yeah, for those of you on TV or Sportsnet Plus, we're in the backup setup today. Everything else, business as usual. I had a nice couple days in New York. Saw Jeff Rosenstock and my buddies in Pup play the Warsaw there. I had to visit the MLB offices, see the literal office of the commissioner, the World Series trophy, the World Baseball Classic trophy, the little spaceship Mike Petriello does his Blue Jay Central hits out of. It was cool. Meanwhile, the Jays went 2-2 against the Red Sox while I was off. They'll settle the series today with a Game 5, Bowden Francis against Cutter Crawford. We will have Jonathan Papelbon on to talk about it. We'll also talk to Molly Burkhart and Levi Weaver in the second hour. Right now, though, the voice of the Toronto Blue Jays joins us. It's Ben Schulman. Ben, how we doing, buddy?
Doing well. I do have to correct you because you got to escape all of this annoying nonsense and technicalities, really, the suspended game. It's not a 2-2 series, but rather, Red Sox are up 2-1 in the series. The Blue Jays won a series in June, finishing it in August. And today, the Blue Jays will try to split a series, even though they've already won 2 games this week.
Technically, yes. Technically, buzz off. how was Monday calling that game? And obviously, like, you know, by the end, I think we were all like, okay, we get it, the technicalities and things like that. But I really don't imagine you're ever going to call a game like that again.
Yeah, I don't think so. I kind of hope not, to be honest. It was really awkward feeling. It was, you know, when we started the game and got into the broadcast to start a game, and now you're in the second inning and here's strike 2 on the first pitch of the day, and you're trying to get through stuff and it's only a couple more pitches until the inning is over. It was a weird day. It was fun. There was some quirky, you know, fun technicalities to it that were interesting to talk about, but overall it felt incredibly unnecessary, to be honest, and really something that didn't need to happen, making up a game 2 months later while for some reason keeping one inning of scoring alive.
Well, there was an even worse one this week. Now, I get it that they were able to just continue, but Rangers-White Sox on Monday or Tuesday, got suspended in literally the first plate appearance, and then the subsequent game was still the resumption of a suspended game, which I guess because it's the next day, it doesn't really matter that much. But there was not a single out recorded. Obviously, this is like a pandemic era holdover when doubleheaders were 7 innings and they were just trying to get everything in. But we should probably amend this back to the old rule, like especially a 0-0 game in the second inning. The suspended thing, like we can do better than this.
Yeah, I think there's an argument for, you know, if it's the fifth inning or, you know, if it's 7-6, I think that you could make an argument. I think if you're in a scoreless ball game in the first 3 innings of a game and the rainout ends it, let's just wipe this slate clean. I don't really see what the point of continuing a game like that is. No one would have gained an advantage really from that game being reset. I mean, technically the Blue Jays had an advantage. They had a runner on base, but it's one runner on base in the grand scheme of things in the second inning of a game. So it was odd. I mean, it really doesn't make sense. I don't think they'll change it though, probably because it's just not top of mind, I would guess, that they just don't care. And I guess in the meantime, we get to see things like Brian Servin hitting leadoff for the Blue Jays. So that's the fun side effect.
We also get to, as I prep for tonight's game, be like, when the heck did Cutter Crawford pitch against the Blue Jays this year? It's like, oh yeah, he got those 4 outs in the suspended game that still count. We also, I will say last note on this, because again, I think everyone's kind of tired of it. I was pretty glad, and I don't know if this is why, but you and I had talked about on the weekend down at the ballpark that Jose Berríos could have lost his consecutive start streak of like almost 200 consecutive starts without missing one for a bullpen appearance, without missing one for an IL stint or anything like that. I'm glad they switched the plan up on that one to save, because as much as like a streak like that probably only means something to Jose Berríos, it's probably pretty meaningful to him to have like, hey, I've made like 170 or whatever it is starts in a row.
Yeah, they never said that they did it because of that, but it wouldn't surprise me if Barrios felt that way and potentially if that came into the decision making. But you're right. I mean, I think it's a streak that is pretty rare around baseball. It's something that I think Jose should probably be very proud of. And so to keep that intact is something good, as I knock on wood, because going 9 years without an IL stint as a starting pitcher is pretty crazy.
It is borderline witchcraft, I think. Yeah. Okay. So the other parts of this series, we can leave the technicality nonsense aside now. Man, Fenway, hearing the quotes come out of this, and like every time you get to see Ali Khan post on social media, the guys, signing the Inside the Monster and things like that. I know you're not there right now, but you've done Fenway before, right?
I've been there as a fan.
Okay. How cool is that to you? Like, where does that rank among ballparks from the fan and history aspect of things?
That's my absolute number one overall, to be honest. I love Fenway Park. I think that it's the coolest place. I mean, you obviously kind of have a two-horse race if you're someone who likes the old parks with Wrigley. Fenway and Wrigley. Wrigley is super cool. It's a little bit renovated. It's probably a better viewer experience. Fenway is like, welcome to 1921 or whatever it is. You know, I know it wasn't built in 1921, but you just feel like you're right there, really, in the old ballpark. It's uncomfortable. The seats are really close together. There's no leg room at all. There's a huge obstructions in front of tons of seats. Sweet Caroline in the eighth inning. It's like nowhere else, I really think. I've really loved going to Fenway. I remember after COVID, the first game that I went to was a Blue Jays game at Fenway Park. It's really, I think, a one-of-one unique place in all of sports, and definitely the first one I would recommend to people if they were trying to go see some ballparks.
Definitely. I've been there a few times. I've never been there as media. I've been there a few times as a fan, including 2015, I went for a series. I got to sit on the monster for one game, and Justin Smoke like hit a grand slam like in our laps. And then later in the weekend, everyone else was like a little too banged up. But I went to a game and sat like right near Pesky's pole, and Russell Martin hit an 11th inning home run, like right down the line there. So I got a pretty incredible season. I think that was early in the 2015 season before things had really picked up for that team. So I'm with you, man. It's right near the top. The Jays did nothing offensively yesterday. Made no advantage of Pesky's bowl or the monster or anything like that. Brian Baio is an interesting one, because I think like some of the Red Sox exceptionalism, like, oh, he's baby Pedro, like people have rolled their eyes at it a little bit, but like you see it yesterday, not the Pedro comp, but just in general, how good this guy could potentially be if he figures it out. What did you see from Baio yesterday?
Yeah, he was great. I mean, you know, he's not Pedro Martinez, and it's unfortunate that guy has good changeup pitching for Red Sox means, you know, that he's going to get all these Pedro comparisons coming up. But he was really, really good with all three of his main pitches. I think that, he started the game off with some really good sliders, kind of kept the Blue Jays off balance. That way, delivered a heck of a fastball to Vlad to strike him out in the first inning. And then he kind of switched it up to more changeups second time through, really neutralized the lefties with the changeups and just located the whole day, kept his velocity the whole day. I mean, he did everything right. Like, the Blue Jays probably did a handful of things wrong. You know, you never want to have two hits and one walk, but I thought every single at bat, he made next to no mistakes. Like, he just did not give them an opportunity to go hit a pitch left over the plate, and everything is 97 or high 80s with him. There's no, oh, if he hangs this curveball, well, that's a 75 mile per hour meatball. So he was all over the Blue Jays hitters all day. And right when I think they started to feel comfortable, you know, he'd flip a right-on-right changeup in that someone wasn't expecting. So it was, I would have to imagine it was Brian Baio's best day of the season, maybe one of the best, if not the best of his career. And that's the potential that I think the Red Sox have been talking about, and the reason that they've committed pretty well financially to a guy who's still pretty unproven.
Yeah, I would argue pretty confidently it's the best outing of his career, right? The two hits and a walk over eight innings, and like were we not in the pitch count era, he would have absolutely gotten to close that one out. I think he finished with 97 pitches over eight innings or something like that. So really good stuff there. On the Jays side, I mean, like you said, there's not a ton you can do. They quite literally like almost didn't barrel up anything. The entire, like Vlad had a ground out and a single that were the only balls hit above 95 miles an hour the entire day. Like they didn't even, sometimes with these ground ball guys, you think like, oh, they're going to get loud outs on the ground. And it wasn't even that. It was all just soft stuff on the ground. I mean, Vlad has been on such a heater the last couple months anyway, but what does it tell you when he's a guy that can still, you know, on a day Bayo's that good, that he's the guy who can still get a hit and the only guy hitting anything remotely hard off of him?
I think it just continues to reinforce where he's at. You know, I think that he's a guy who the last couple of years would have been, you know, picking up enough hits because he hits the ball so hard, even if there's some flaws. You know, he's going to have a decent kind of season where, you know, he's 280 with a high 700s, low 800s OPS. Now he's in a spot where he's just having a few of these days where he's putting the ball on the ground a ton. He still picks up hits or hits the ball hard on his bad days. And now his good days are really, really good. And that's why he's pushing in 1,000 OPS late in this season. So I think for Vlad, it's just another reason to believe that he's in a completely different place than he was before. I think that he's, frankly, one of the best hitters in baseball. I really do. I mean, we watch him every day, and that'll influence you in his direction, certainly. But it is unbelievable to see a guy do what he's doing right now. He's still one of the youngest guys on the team, even with the whole baby Blue Jays movement and all these quote-unquote young guys up from AAA. Most of them are still older than he is. And it's unbelievable to think what this has been and what 2 years from now could be and what 4 years from now could be, because it seems like it's all coming together at the right time for Vlad personally. For the Blue Jays, that'll be a bigger question going forward.
Yeah. Up to 955 OPS. And I think obviously the hot streak kind of started in mid-May, but even if you isolate to the last 30 days, like a 220 weighted runs created plus, I think over the last month. So Vlad was the only one to hit a ball hard yesterday. The only other player to do literally anything on the positive ledger was Addison Barger. And he had kind of a soft liner to left field he worked a 7-pitch at bat against Bayo and then was able to kind of take one the other way, a sinker that just got left a little too in. And then he also took a walk. So 12 pitches total over those two plate appearances. Barger has been, you know, quietly a little better in this stint. He still doesn't get on base a ton, but because he hits the ball hard, you know, an OPS just north of 800 in his latest recall here. What have you seen from Barger and similarly to, you know, Vlad obviously at the high end, but the fact that Barger is comfortable enough right now that he was a guy who was able to get something off Bayo, you know, that's on paper to me, someone Barger, at least what we saw earlier in the year, would probably struggle with.
Yeah, in theory, I think you look at Bayo with this changeup and you think he's probably going to exploit a power-free swinger like Barger. But, you know, Barger obviously hits the ball hard. So like you said, the OPS is good even when the on-base isn't, because everything he hits feels like a double or a homer. Even when he hits it softly, somehow he's hitting it down the line and finding a way to an extra base hit. And now he's kind of pairing that with just being a little bit more selective, a little bit more, not tentative, maybe just calculated is a better word, with two strikes with his swing. I think he's still striking out, certainly, but a little bit less. He's cut down his swing a little bit with two strikes. Put the ball in play approach or foul it off approach is a little bit more apparent. And because of that, he's got hits in six straight, not including the suspended games, really seven straight, and is really starting to, I think, put some things together. If he can just put the bat on the ball enough and get on base a little bit, he should not, I think, have to be even league average at doing that to be a very productive hitter, because he hits everything so hard that getting Barger just a little bit more contact has been big for the Blue Jays. And it's interesting. I mean, they've pushed him right up the order. They've done this with different guys at different times, but they're hitting him behind Vlad sometimes, or hitting him behind Horwitz, I think it was yesterday, in the number five spot. He's getting some decent assignments here that he was not getting in his first 40 odd games.
Yeah, and I would imagine we'll see him there again today against Cutter Crawford, because worked well yesterday. Why go away from it? That's another right-handed pitcher. So I want to stick with the positives here. There are some, obviously, they only had three base runners yesterday. We could pick at some negatives, but I haven't done the show in a couple of days. Want to stick with some positives. Will Wagner has been quite good. Obviously, he had the first career home run. Talked about how special it was for it to be at Fenway. Obviously, his dad played for the Red Sox when he was like 11 years old or something like that as well. Overall, looking at the body of work Will Wagner's done since he's come up, very different stylistically than Addison Barger recently or Vlad or anything like that. Kind of weirdly, since they just acquired a more like prototypical Jays prospect. What have you seen from Will Wagner that encourages you about, you know, his potential to keep this up?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was great to see him kind of bounce back early in this series. You know, he had a really rough time, I think, on the homestand and the start of this road trip on Monday. But to come up with that big game and just kind of, you know, tilt his numbers forward again, I think was really nice to see. I've loved the at-bats all the way throughout. I mean, I think there are questions certainly about what the ceiling potentially is. But when you look at the floor of a guy like Will Wagner, he makes contact. He makes pretty hard contact. It's not like Barger, where he's, you know, hitting the ball high in the air a lot of the time, where it can go for homers or often is going to be doubles, but he's hitting it so hard that it's getting through the infield constantly, and it is getting into gaps for doubles sometimes. And he really has a great idea, I think, of the strike zone. He seems to really understand what pitchers are trying to do to him. You know, insert talking about Billy Wagner as his dad right here, but he really does seem, you know, to get to two strikes and spot that changeup right out of the hand of Brian Bale, because he probably knows, you know, that's the obvious call. And not that other guys aren't thinking about that too, but for Wagner, being a guy 2 weeks, 3 weeks into his major league career, he really does seem to have a firm understanding of that. So I'll be interested to see how the season goes on, and still, you know, even if he finishes the season with a 350 average, still be curious as to what he is actually as a player going forward. But I think that there are a lot of signs here of someone who can contribute in some way at the major league level.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, obviously, the Jays have done a lot of the second generation talent stuff, and it can get like, oh, LOL, like it's a little quirky. And it's true. Some of it is a little quirky and a little random. But there's also an element of like, you've been around. There is, you know, you've seen a lot of baseball. Like, my theory on how Dalton Varsho has become such a good outfielder, and it's not perfect because, you know, every son of an outfielder is not Dalton Varsho. There's only one Dalton Varsho. But part of it is like, you spent your entire childhood seeing fly balls at that level, and like your brain kind of puts together that chunking mechanism that your brain has for like pattern recognition and filling in the gaps and stuff. I'd imagine there's a little bit of that of, hey, what are pitchers going to do to you and attack you? What does this look like? What does defense look like? I think there's something there. On the Varsho note, 0 for yesterday, but had been on a real streak, whether you include that game or not. A lot of multi-hit games, a home run earlier in the series. He has quietly got his season line back up to league average, which, as always this year, is an indictment on the league. It's a 709 OPS. But man, what have you seen from him in this turnaround? And just how valuable is it for this Jays team if he can be like he has been right now for the season, even just like a league average bat?
Yeah, it's been pretty big. I mean, he's been moved up to the top of the order and produced at a level that's provided RBI chances for Vlad and for the guys behind him. And that's pretty massive for the Blue Jays. I think when I look at Varsho, two things have stood out to me over the 23-game on-base streak that's now come to an end. I think he took his walks, which is pretty big for him, you know, laying off some of those up-and-in pitches, those down-and-away pitches, something we've talked about all year. But another thing I haven't tracked exactly, you know, to the numbers, but eye test for me, seemed like he put the ball on the ground a little bit more, which isn't necessarily what you want all the time, but he is literally the highest launch angle guy in all of baseball. He mostly because of the high pop-up rate. And I think putting the ball on the ground kind of gave him a chance to keep this streak going a little bit more, because he found one or two holes, or he beat out a couple plays with his speed. And not that I want him, you know, chopping wood and doing that every single time, but I think just being a little bit more balanced with the contact didn't hurt, because he is a quick guy and he can create some opportunities if he hits it to the right spot. So I think it just kind of made him a little bit more consistent rather than some of the boom or bust that we saw middle portion, maybe earlier in the season.
And again, don't need him to be a 350 OBP guy. Just need him to hang around this like 700, 725 OPS range. And yeah, you're going to finish the season as a 4 wins above replacement player, because the defense and the base running is so strong. He's got a shot to finish with his third straight 20 home run season as well. Ben, tonight it's going to be Bowden Francis on the mound. I won't repeat his quote, although he has sworn on this show before as well, in addition to the Sportsnet broadcast after his last one. Look, obviously we all had a lot of fun with that one. I was there as a fan for that game, took the no-hitter into the ninth. There was the fun stuff with Chris Bassitt the next day after Taylor Ward's comments. How interested are you in seeing how all of that looks today against a stronger lineup? Not obviously, you know, he had a couple good starts against Baltimore too, but they weren't quite as good as his starts against the Angels. This is a Red Sox team that's ninth in offense overall and seventh against right-handed hitters. How much do you think we learn about where Bowden's at tonight?
I think it's a really good test, to be honest. I think that this is another hurdle that I'd be looking for Bowden to clear. I think the first one was just getting some good starts in, which he did. The second one, you know, was facing the Angels the second time, even though they're not a great baseball team. You know, I think that a team seeing his splitter more than once, seeing how they react to that, can they catch up to it? Clearly they could not, you know, despite however hittable they felt it was. They only came up with one hit in 8+. And now it's kind of, okay, the scouting report is out on you for a while, and now you're facing a pretty good team, you know, like an offense that for a long time in this season was one of the better offenses in baseball. We'll see if Devers is in the lineup tonight, but I think this will be a tough test for Bowden. You know, some of the mistakes that were left over the plate that maybe weren't punished against, an Angels lineup or a Cubs lineup, Jaron Duran right now is going to punish those. And if Devers is in the lineup, he's going to punish it. And we saw what O'Neill does to pitches that arguably weren't even mistakes from Brendan Little yesterday. So I think that this is a huge one for Bowden. It's not be all end all. If he makes another great start, it doesn't mean he's Cy Young still. And if he gets lit up, I don't think that it means that he's out of the rotation for next year, but it's a big test, and really the next couple starts for him against more formidable, more kind of in the hunt for the playoff opponents. I think that's a run where I'm going to look at 4 or 5 in a row to end the season and start to form my opinion about Francis for next year around that.
Yeah, and, you know, a pretty lefty-heavy lineup today. If Devers is in there from the Red Sox, then I think, yeah, he lines up to see the Phillies and the Mets his next two after that, if they, you know, if they stay on turn. We'll see. They've got 5 off days in September and an extra body coming to the pitching staff as well at that point. I should note, by the way, for anyone tracking this stuff, Jake Bloss got absolutely lit up at AAA last night. 8 earned and 3 homers over 1 2/3, 60 pitches. Still imagine he's in the mix at some point. Ben, is there anyone front of mind for you? Like, we are, what's today, 29th? So we're going to get September call-ups this weekend. Is there anyone you're looking at when you check those Bison's box scores or tune into a game that you'd like to see get at least a short-term shot here?
I mean, it's mostly Jonathan Clase. You know, and he has not had a storied start to his Buffalo career. But as a guy who's already played in the majors, I'm not sure that I care as much about him playing well at AAA before coming up. I think that there's probably a good case to be made to get him up anyway, so the Blue Jays can assess what they have in him as a guy that could be potentially a part of the team next year. You know, I just on a personal level, and I think that it would be great if Nathan Lucas got a little bit of time up. I think that Nathan Lucas, while, you know, kind of in the mix, like some of, you know, like an Ernie Clement or others who haven't played a ton at the majors, aren't necessarily young, so he's not like a huge future piece, but Nathan Lucas would have been up with the Blue Jays for a while this year, I strongly believe, if he didn't get hurt. But he had that thumb surgery and the Blue Jays had to go to other options. I would love to see him just as a guy that's been in the organization and helped out this team a lot in the past, get a little bit of time. But I really, from a prospect perspective, I think I lean most toward Class A. If they didn't go to Bloss as the pitcher, you know, Mason Fluharty's had a pretty decent year, and he was an interesting guy, I remember, in spring. You know, maybe they try him out, although they already have a lot of lefties. But a lot of the guys that I want to see are already here, to be honest. And I mean, one of those extra roster spots could be taken by Bo Bichette. So we'll have to see what happens. But with only one player and one pitcher spot, there might not be earth-shattering promotions in September.
It is amusing to imagine if this were still the 40 roster spot September era, where like the Brandon Eichert, Jose Kwas, Jerry Rodriguez, Luis Frias, Easton Lucas are all here like this weekend, or all in Minnesota this weekend, and it's just like you never know who's coming out of the bullpen because there are 15 guys back there. Yeah, and the other thing to consider with all this as well is if a guy's not on the 40 man, you know, the can't, like Alan Roden is the guy who performance wise I'd be most interested to see, but he doesn't need a 40 man spot until after the 2025 season for Rule 5 protection. So unless you think he's really going to be in the mix next year, you know, to put him on the 40 man to burn an option next year on him already, those kind of things come into play as well. And they could clear a 40 man if they needed one real easily with how many guys are on there now. But yeah, I think, you know, Lucas or Class A, maybe Luis De Los Santos, but I'd probably lean toward one of those other guys as well. Last one before I let you go here, Ben. The Jays had a chance to be big spoilers for the Red Sox if they could have taken, say, 5 out of 5 in this quote-unquote series. They have the chance to help the Red Sox a lot if they were to lose this game tonight and then do some damage against the Twins on the weekend. What do you make of where the Red Sox are at? And like that three-game gap for the final wild card has felt big at times, even though they've stayed around the three-game mark. Do you think that is a good enough team to close that gap over September here?
I think it's possible. You know, I'm not sure that if you made me bet on it right now that I would bet that they close that gap, but I do think they have enough talent. I think the tough thing for the Red Sox, you know, early in the year they had some injuries and a little bit of underperformance from the bats, but that has completely changed. I mean, I think you're seeing, you know, Costas help out a lot. Yoshida's had a great second half. Devers is Devers, even though Connor Wong has slowed down. I think for the most part, you know, you can rely upon those bats. But their pitching has shifted from one of the better staffs in baseball to, over the last couple months, one of the lesser staffs in baseball. And that's tough to have your pitching in a bad spot while you're in the race. Their starters have not been incredibly consistent recently. And their pen is a little bit, both are kind of a little all over the place. I mean, you know, you get James Paxton back, then he gets hurt. Then Criswell, who you knocked out of the rotation, now you got to throw him back in the rotation. I love the story, but you're signing 44-year-old Rich Hill to be a part of your bullpen amid a playoff race. I think that a lot has to turn for them. They're not playing their best baseball. They've lost something like 12 of 20, even with the two wins over the Blue Jays recently. But I still think that they have good pieces. I think that their starters could turn it around. We've seen them be good over the course of multiple months this year. And Minnesota isn't a juggernaut to me. They're solid and they've kind of been solid all year, but if Minnesota went 500 the rest of the season, it wouldn't shock me if the Red Sox could go 5 games above 500, but they don't have a lot of tiebreakers there. So they're in some difficult situations like that too. And the more you talk about it, the less I believe the Red Sox will be in there, but I do think they have a chance still to make that run.
And again, Jays can do them a favor tonight and this weekend. Not that you want to do that. I was hoping I would come back and the first show back would be like, yeah, Jays buried the Red Sox while I was off. Instead, they have quote unquote split. Ben, thanks for taking the time out this morning, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Schulman, voice of the Blue Jays on the Sportsnet radio network. I mentioned, yeah, just a couple quick notes here before break. I mentioned Jake Bloss got shelled at AAA yesterday. 8 earned, 3 homers over 1 2/3. Alan Roden stayed real hot down there. Josh Kasevich, friend of the show, had a 3-hit game. Nathan Lucas has been really hot since his return. He had an 0 for yesterday, though. No real updates on Bo Bichette or Jordan Romano either. Expect to see them at some point in September, but nothing imminent. Romano, I believe, expected to begin a throwing progression this week. We're going to talk more Romano later in the show because he was a key piece of a really fun Molly Burkhart piece at MLB.com on pitchers grunting and how it can actually help your velocity. We'll talk to Levi Weaver in that second hour as well. But after the break, we're going to talk to Jonathan Papelbon about this Red Sox team. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That music, of course, means it's time to talk to Jonathan Papelbon of Nesson, of Foul Territory. He joins us now. Jonathan, man, how are you?
Doing well, man. Doing well. Running around Boston up here and trying to fight it out with you Blue Jays up here in the booth.
Man, I played you in with your song, but I got to ask you a different music question. How was Kenny Chesney at Gillette Stadium last week?
Oh, man, it was great. It was great. You know, Boston were referred to kind of as the city of champions, so I got to go hang out with future or former champions in this city that, you know, guys like Gronk and Nink and a couple Bruins players and McAvoy. So, you know, I mean, good, man. It was good. It was a good time. Ended up beating Gronk in cornhole about 3 o'clock in the morning, so it turned out great.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you were doing anything at 3 a.m. after a concert, know that well from New York this week myself. Must have been a good one. Okay, this series, man, before we get into the nitty-gritty, the actual baseball being played, did you ever figure out what the heck Tristan Casas was doing on Tuesday with like the ski mask and the big glasses and just like warming up shirtless? Is that just the Tristan Casas experience?
Apparently that is the Tristan Casas experience to a T. And the report that we got back in the studio was, is a way, don't quote me on this, but it's a way to balance out the sunlight in the body and the way it receives it and all this other kind of really kind of out there stuff that I had no clue. He lost me after that.
Yeah, well, it'll be an interesting matchup between him and Bowden Francis tonight then, because I haven't seen Bowden Francis dress like that, but another guy who, you know, gets deep into the, you know, the energy and the feeling and things like
grounding
that.
Grounding of the earth.
And yeah.
Forces, you know, yeah.
You never had anything like that, eh? You were just kind of, you go out there and pitch?
I would just pretty much go out there, maybe take a shot of Jägermeister and go pitch.
Okay. So inside the lines, how impressed are you with Casas? Obviously when he's healthy, he's put up really good numbers this year. I think his OPS is almost 900, still just 24. How much has he impressed you when he's able to get in there between the lines?
Yeah, I mean, definitely is professional hitter. No question about it. Takes his job very serious, puts in a lot of work physically and mentally. So, I mean, I respect the hell out of him, you know, for that. And, you know, takes it. He took his time to get back here with us because I think he knew what it took. I mean, he didn't come up and struggle. He came up. I mean, he had a 4-strikeout game, but big deal. He's raking since he's been back.
Yeah.
And hitting the cover off the ball, but he knew himself how to prepare. And a lot of times, you know, athletes in general that know themselves more than anything, more than any coach or can be their own coach, usually tend to be very good.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it. And you know, from here, it seems like he's usually a pretty insightful interview and things like that as well. I started with the Casas thing because, you know, that clip was funny and you guys having fun with it was funny. But the story of last night was obviously Brian Baio. He goes 8 shutout innings, a ton of ground balls, some good strikeouts. Is that the best you've seen Baio so far?
Yeah, that's his best game this year so far. And when I say his best game so far, I mean that he went out there and just about every pitch he threw was competitive, was a competitive pitch and had a reason to the pitch. And, you know, for me, the Red Sox will be able to do absolutely nothing as far as get to the playoffs or even do anything in the playoffs, okay? We're three games back right now. But they won't be able to – if they don't have Bayo pitch like he did last night or pitch, you know, somewhat relative to what he did last night, each time he goes out there for his next, say, six starts he's going to have before the season is over or we get towards the end of the season – So if they don't have that, they don't have a chance. And of course, you know, Tanner Houck is going to have to go out there. There's some things that are going to happen. We are right on the line and on the cusp of this, you know, wild card race, which I think now even on a side note, I think it's good to be in the wild. I don't like the whole, you know, bye, you know, you get the bye because in baseball, man, you don't want to be sitting for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, it's a interesting one, right? Where like, you know, you don't want to lose a bad luck two game series. But yeah, it struck me when they introduced the new rules that, you know, especially for like you guys, like relief pitchers, like you're just down for 5 days. It's, I don't know. It'd be a weird one from a rhythm perspective, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like in 07, when we won the World Series, it was, I think Colorado had like 5 days off and you could visually, and we had kept playing to like a game seven. You could visually tell that they were just a tick behind us. I mean, you know, you as an athlete, you can tell. We were like, oh man, they're, but then by game two and three, they caught back up.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So I don't know. I think personally I'd take the bye, but it's a tough one, right? Like, how do you stay ready over those couple days while you're just watching? Got to get there. One more for you on Bayo. What you saw last night versus what you've seen when his ERA was up closer to 5 this year, you know, this is a young pitcher still figuring out. He's only 25. But where is that gap for you? Like what was different last night than has been there earlier in the year?
Two things I noticed was his ability to stay in the moment and go pitch to pitch and stay focused on the task at hand and not try to worry about what possibly could happen. Just be in the moment. He went from pitch to pitch to pitch. Secondly, the walks. The walks are, I mean, the previous outing before last night, I think he had 4 or 5 walks. Last night against the Blue Jays, I think in 8 innings had 1. So, and also our team had no errors. We lead the league. We lead all Major League Baseball in errors, and you know we didn't make an error. So that goes hand in hand, walks and errors. But the walks and his composure on the mound, by far.
Well, it wasn't good to see from a Jays perspective, but it's good to see because that is a really exciting young pitcher when he's on. I wanted to ask you about another exciting young pitcher who just got the call. Rich Hill is back with the Red Sox. I know you got to catch up with him the other day. Man, as a former teammate of his who's younger than him and seeing him back in the majors again, how fun has this been for you as his friend?
Oh, it's been great. It's been great. I actually gave him a big hug the other day because it's been a while since I've seen him. I said, you know, you're actually a few days older than me or a couple of months. I know he's just older than me. So, yeah, it's amazing. And you know what? Rich knows this game well. He knows himself well. He knows he's not going to go out there and start striking everybody out and throwing in 1-1 ball games and stuff. He's here to just, you know, give the Red Sox just a little bit of lift on covering some innings. He's going to try to come up here and cover innings that, you know, our main guys might need a day off. I'm going to cover you and, you know, come try and get some outs for the club or maybe spot start towards the end of the season. That's if it all goes well, but he's still got a curveball that can get guys out. And I truly believe that now the fastball and change up other stuff, maybe not so much, but he's got one.
So he's 44, you're 43, you played until you were 35 and you were still pretty good at 35. How incredible is it that he can still do it? Like, can you imagine yourself still trying to pitch at this point?
No, but he's also always been your Greg Maddux type style, not your power pitchers,
right.
You know? So, you know, to me, it's just a sign of his ability to be able to go out there despite his age and get people out. And obviously with that comes, okay, yeah, I still love this and I still want to go through the grind of it. You know, 12 years of grinding it out and being ready every night was enough for me. I didn't find that need. And once I lost that, I knew I wasn't going to just hang around. I didn't want to just hang around. I wanted to do something at the highest level if I was just playing in the highest level. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, you did it 12 years is a good time. You're very high on the all-time saves leader list, right? Like, you did it. Wanted to ask you about another guy on that saves leaders list. Kenley Jansen is 36 now. Not to make everything about age, but he's having one of the best seasons of his career. What have you seen from him? What has made – I'd imagine he's a guy you understand well, given that, you know, again, the closer role throws a little harder, really good into the 30s. What do you think's gone into Kenley having yet another really good year here?
Well, I think he's a consummate pro. He knows what, and he's his own coach, right? He doesn't need a pitching coach. He doesn't need a strength coach. He doesn't need a mental coach. You know, when you get to these kind of points in your career, you know, you understand every little tiny aspect way more than you did when you're, you know, 23, 22 years old. So I think that's what makes him so successful.
It's been fun to see. Okay, he has, so his walkouts, obviously you became like synonymous with your walkout song, Dropkick Murphys, It Fits the Market and stuff like that. Do you like his, like that rap with the little bit of bagpipes underneath it?
No, because I'm not a cross generation music type guy. You know, I don't cross music. I mean, I'm not one of those, you know, country rap song guys, you know. I just pretty much like, you know, just some good old rock and roll and some country music, man.
There you go. And some, I mean, obviously Dropkick Murphys for you to come out. Okay, last one before I let you go here. You had a 1.66 career ERA against the Blue Jays. So this market saw the very best of Jonathan Papelbon. Is that something you're like aware of?
You checking me out now. I see you.
I mean, I remember, like, I've been there at Fenway when you shut down lineups. I've been here at Rogers Center when you do it.
I had pretty good years against y'all.
Yeah, like, it's fun to talk to you, but it's not fun to think back on those. Like, were you aware of that as a player? Like, hey, I've owned this team a little bit?
100%. And on the opposite end of that, you also know, oh, crap, this guy's freaking killed me. You know who owns you too. So, and you know, even as a team, like, there was times when we'd walk into the Rogers Center with, you know, Mike Lowell hitting six and Manny hitting fourth and Pedroia leading off. Like, we knew we were just going to come there and just take care of business. You know it, like, you can feel it.
Yeah, it's got to be a fun feeling. It'll be a fun one tonight as the Red Sox try to take this series. What are you looking for from Cutter Crawford if the Red Sox are going to win this one?
Well, Cutter's got to get through five at least, you know, and he's had problems with, you know, getting even to the six here lately. So, you know, with the Blue Jays lineup, you know, to me, if I'm a starter against them, all you got to do is be competitive in the zone, right? This is a team, in my opinion, besides a few hitters, don't get themselves out. You know, but you got to make your pitches, right? You got to make them hit your pitches. And you can do that with this Blue Jays lineup. So he's obviously going to have to go out. And like I was speaking earlier, he can't walk, man. Cutter's got to keep the walks down as well. And I'm not necessarily looking for him to have a bunch of strikeouts. Like, he doesn't need to go out there and strike out everybody to win against the Blue Jays, because they'll put the ball in play and give you ground ball outs. But, you know, this has been a good series so far, man. It really has. Like, the doubleheader, y'all took the first two. Then we take the next two night games. And, you know, I mean, this is a good little series. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Rare to get a five-gamer. Weird with the suspended game and all that nonsense. But it's been a fun one. Jonathan, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. This was really fun.
Okay, guys. Take care, man.
Jonathan Papelbon of Nesson, of foul territory, and second all-time in saves against the Toronto Blue Jays. I mentioned his 1.66 career ERA against this team. This is a wild stat. So Jonathan Papelbon is the second most saves ever against the Jays. He has 27. In first place is Mariano Rivera with 54. Twice as many saves against the Blue Jays as the next highest guy. That's wild. Double. And like, it's not obviously the Yankees were good for longer. Rivera played a little bit longer. But like, Papelbon had a better ERA against the Jays than Rivera. Just, man, 54 saves against one team. It's crazy. Cool to talk to Jonathan Papelbon. I didn't want to say this to him, but I have not invented stats, but I think I've talked on the show before about the Adam Dunn hat trick, the you homer, strikeout, and walk in the same game. I also have one that I'll look up sometimes, and I call it the Papelbon. And it's, you have three strike, you strike out the side, but you also put three base runners on in the inning and didn't allow a run. And I use that because I saw him, I went to a White Sox Red Sox game the first time I ever went to Fenway, and the Red Sox were up by three, and he loaded the bases and then struck out the side. So I call it the Papelbon. Although when I looked it up, Devin Williams is actually the all-time leader in doing the Papelbon. But Adam Dunn's not the all-time leader in the Adam Dunn hat trick either. So what are you going to do? We are going to talk to Molly Burkhart and Levi Weaver on the other side. We're also going to set you up, get a little deeper on Cutter Crawford, a little deeper on what's gone well for Bowden Francis and how maybe he matches up with this Red Sox team that does not hit splitters very well, even though they hit right-handed pitching well. We're also going to take some of your texts in the second hour, so you can send those to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. We'll sprinkle those in throughout today. We'll sprinkle those in throughout tomorrow as well, since it's a Friday. Friday always feels like a good day for text. So yeah, text us at 590-590. There are a couple in there right now, and sorry if I missed them over the last couple of days. I was not checking the text line while I was in New York. Fred in Moncton asked, who's the best closer in Jays history? I think it's pretty clearly Tom Hanke, right? Like we could get into some of the like more, you know, nitty gritty stats or whatever, you know, win probability, leveraged ERA, even things like that. I think Tom Hanke has such a big gap in the saves leaderboard. It would be hard for me to go with anyone else in that spot. What gets interesting after that, though, is like, who's the second best? Because like, Dwayne Ward is in there and there's some overlap with those years. And it was kind of the dual threat bullpen. But Dwayne Ward also had like, you know, an ERA that was a little high for a closer. Jordan Romano is third on the saves list. Billy Koch had a really short peak, but had like probably one of the most dominant closer seasons. BJ Ryan was not particularly good. It's a pretty grim list of Blue Jays closers historically. Osuna's in there, Casey Jansen, Kelvin Escobar, converted starter. I think it's pretty clearly Tom Hanke. Ed and Aurelia asks, since Vladdy and Barger have both gone to a more of a neutral stance at the plate, their hitting production has greatly improved. That's something, you know, to Joe Siddle's talked a lot about tracking Vlad's hand placement and things like that. There's the Barger, you know, leg kick / toe tap that's changed a little bit. Spencer Horwitz with the angle of his bat knob toward the catcher. Look, part of hitting is there are always going to be these little tweaks you're making, and you know, when a hitter changes something, it doesn't mean it's going to work for every other person. You just got to find what works for you. And the honest truth is you look at over the course of Vlad's career, or Barger a couple years down the line, or Horwitz a couple years down the line, guys are tweaking all the time. Something's going to work and feel great. And then how pitchers are pitching you is going to change a little bit, and you'll have to change something to, you know, hey, I got to cover the outside third of the plate more, or they're banging me with more heat up and in and things like that. It's why it's, you know, I think hitting is impossibly hard. And I think one of the most fascinating things about talking to hitters and hitting coaches and things like this is that even when you're a very, very good hitter, it is just a constant search for, you know, even when things are going well, for fixing things, right? Like the old adage that you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're a Hall of Famer, is like pretty true. And it's the challenge of hitting and constantly tweaking your swing and things like that is, I don't know, it would be frustrating, but intellectually it's really interesting. Ed, I don't know if your question, if your text was, you know, to suggest everyone should go more neutral, but I think that, you know, the takeaway from that is that it's, you know, guys are going to keep tweaking and work to find what's right for them. And right now, you know, you might say, hey, David Schneider's probably got to change something. You know, everyone I've talked to is like always more in between. It's not necessarily a mechanical thing, but yeah, guys are going to have to try different stuff all the time. It's a fascinating sport in that regard. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about pitchers grunting on the mound with Molly Burkhart as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, and I'm just getting stranger and stranger with the music picks as we go here. Like I said, we'll talk to Molly Burkhart and Levi Weaver in this hour. We'll get you set up for Jays Red Sox. We'll take some of your texts in the text line, 590, 590, standard data and message rates may apply. Alex in Brantford had asked before the break here, what do you want to see from Bo once he returns? Honestly, I just want to see him get on the field and get some reps in. Like, I'm not going to be looking necessarily at the results, but I think there is a value in him being able to get on the field so that when you get to March 30th or whatever the date is in 2025, it's not the first time he's seen major league in-game pitching for a long time. Like, obviously, you would like to see him hitting better and things like that. But, you know, I'm not, that's 2 weeks at the end of the year coming back from a third injury of the same sort. That's not going to be a results-oriented evaluation. If he hits great, awesome. If he hits poorly, whatever. I think that's more about setting a foundation for 2025. The other injured Blue Jay is Jordan Romano, and something he's probably working on as he starts a throwing progression later this week, which is expected, will be how to time and how to most effectively use his grunts. It is something he talked to our next guest, Molly Burkhart of MLB.com, about recently. Molly joins us now. Molly, how you doing?
I'm good. How's it going?
Good. Okay, so for anyone who didn't see it, you have this terrific piece up at MLB.com doing the grunt work about pitchers who just let it out on the mound and grunt when they pitch. How did you come up with, like, how did the pitch process go of you going to the MLB editors and be like, this is what I want to do. This is my idea for a story. I've had some out there ones. I'd imagine this took a little bit of time.
Yeah, so I've been there about 6 years. So I think by now everyone's used to me coming up with some weird pitches like this. But even with that said, this one was particularly out there. It was just kind of a thought I had in my head, particularly like the 2020 season. We heard it all the time. You know, you were hearing guys let it rip on the mound. And it's known in tennis that people do that to help their serve. And I thought, okay, why are guys doing it on the mound? And I thought, this could go one of two ways. It could be every pitcher who does it just saying exactly that, saying, hey, it's just something I do. It helps me, you know, it's like a get me over little extra oomph on that fastball. There's nothing more to it. Or I could find out that they're weird, you know, pitchers are kind of weird guys. So there could be something more to it. And it turns out there was more to it.
There is a lot to it, and it's different. It seems to differ a little pitcher by pitcher and things like that. What was the process? Like, who was the first pitcher you talked to about it? And like, where was the nerve level of like, I'm going to ask this guy about his grunt and it's going to be, you know, again, we ask some difficult questions in our job sometimes, but the, hey man, why you grunt so much is, I'd imagine, a tough one to break the ice with.
Well, funny, you just mentioned him, Jordan Romano. Is that Blue Jays spring training this year, and I had first talked to the pitching coach, Pete Walker, and he seemed to support the story. He was interested, so that helped me have the confidence to then go to Romano, who I'd never talked to before, and he was coming off of throwing, and, you know, everyone was talking about this and that, and then there I was, hey, can I talk to you about something else real quick? he was actually really great. I mean, he's We've all seen it. He's an intense guy on the mound and, you know, off the mound. And he was great. Everyone kind of took it a lot more seriously than I was expecting. Especially Rich Hill was really, really in depth about his process. Max Scherzer and Romano as well. They took it seriously. It's not a joke.
I want to come back to Scherzer and Hill because there's a little bit of tension between their stories about it, given Max Scherzer's feeling that you should have to throw a certain level of velocity. We'll come back to that one. On the Romano side, though, this is not something he's always done. So this is, you know, when I saw the headline of the piece and the, you know, the subhead and things like that, my first thought was like, is this intent or response? Like are guys intentionally grunting, or do they just grunt because they're trying to throw so hard? And then Romano tells you, he's like, no, I kind of picked it up from Robbie Ray. Was the overarching idea that this is with intent, that the pitchers who do let it out intentionally?
Kind of. So he couldn't pinpoint exactly when, but he thought maybe he picked it up from him. And I think, as I noted, once he started it, he just saw the value in it. And he said he would feel uncomfortable not doing it anymore. But then you have someone like, I was lucky enough to talk to Nolan Ryan, who is kind of like the godfather of the grunt. And he just said there was like nothing more to it than, oh, I just did it. It's just a natural reaction. I couldn't control it. It just came out. So I'd say most guys seem to pick it up at some point in their career for one reason or another. Scherzer was another guy who said he's kind of always done it. But yeah, Nolan Ryan was the outlier of like, no, I've always done it. I don't think about it. And that's just the way it was. And clearly it worked out pretty well for him.
And please, it's not Godfather of the Grunt. He's the Grunt Father. Obviously.
It was right there.
So you mentioned the tennis background of this, and you cited this in your article, but there actually is some correlation that they've found, and I'm sure this hasn't been, you know, the most heavily studied thing in the history of the world, but there is some scientific evidence that this can help you, whether it's a tennis serve or your pitching velocity, get a little more out of your body.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to pretend I'm a scientist or I know, you know, I don't have this, I have a pretty baseline understanding of all this, but I thought if it's proven in tennis, that doesn't translate exactly to baseball, but it has to, you know, there has to be something to it. And I did find one study of like a very small study where it did show that, you know, it does what it's intended to do of like kind of that get me over. If it's just showing that you have a little extra to give, and maybe that's not always showing in like an extra mile an hour on the fastball or whatever, but it is kind of like giving all that you have. And it does seem to be that there's some evidence there. And I hope maybe there'll be more studies, because I did start when you asked about pitching the story, I started by reaching out to MLB Research with probably the weirdest question I've ever asked, which, you know, I knew there wasn't a baseball savant section for, you know, grunt velocity, but I figured I would ask, and there was no way, of course, to tell, but maybe that could be something down the line.
Look, if we can determine perceived velocity based on extension down the mound and the location of the pitch versus the bat path it needs to take and stuff like that, we can absolutely have the science to pick up if a pitcher grunts or not and then track those things. Okay, so Nolan Ryan, Max Scherzer, Jordan Romano, these are guys who throw really, really hard. And if the theory is that grunting helps you get a little bit more on the velocity side, this is all making sense. And then the like guy I think of most grunting when he throws is Rich Hill, who throws like 87, 88. What do we make of him? Like, is he a grunt outlier? Would he throw like 70 without the grunt? I don't know what to make of Rich Hill's inclusion here.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the most interesting guys I talked to for this. We talked for probably half an hour, and he, again, like I wasn't sure what to expect. He took it very seriously, and his reasoning for grunting was more of like a representation of how he's grown as a pitcher. So for other guys, it's like, you know, this is making me throw faster, and for him, it was just showing a display of confidence of, you know, he had been in the league for a long time. He fell off the starting path, which is what he wanted to get back onto. And he thought, okay, I'm at this point in my career where I need to either give it all I've got or give it up, you know? And so he tried grunting and as a way to give it all he had. And yeah, it didn't make him throw 95, but it did give him something that, you know, kind of kept him like highly competitive and showed like who he was as a pitcher, kind of helped shape that. And here he is now, which worked out really well for my story. I'm signing another contract with the Red Sox last week. So clearly it worked out for him.
Yeah, I was actually going, that was going to be my next question. It's a little inside baseball reporting, but like, yeah, did you just hit him up, or was this like very, very recent? So there's the answer. I know you're not from Boston, but you're Boston based now, right?
Correct. Yes.
So how excited are you for like, hey, Rich Hill might get in this game tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I think as far as things go for the Red Sox, I don't know if he's the answer to their, you know, all of their problems, but I think he's someone who at the very least gives you like a veteran presence. He's been in the game for a very long time. He's been with the Red Sox for multiple iterations of, you know, this franchise. And so he gives you that veteran presence in the clubhouse. And then if he gets out on the mound, yeah, again, he's, you know, he might be throwing 87 mile an hour fastballs, but whatever, if he can eat some innings for you, get out there, hopefully bridge the gap for them, then I think a lot of people will be excited to see him out there.
We'll have to ask Max Scherzer if he can give one pass to the 95 mile an hour grunting rule. Hey, like Rich Hill's grandfathered in or something
like
that. Yeah,
I'd say it at this point, yeah.
Okay, I have two silly follow-up questions for you on this.
Love that, yeah.
The first, do you think Decoy grunted when he threw out the first pitch to Shohei Ohtani last night?
That's not a silly question. That's a fantastic question. and I'm going to say yes. Decoy strikes me as a grunter. He ran off that mound with a lot of... he was going pretty quickly. He needed to have a grunt in there.
For sure. He was. And if not that, then waiting for the treat. Absolutely making some noise there.
Absolutely.
And then I guess the other one, and again, this is silly, but if grunting is correlated with an uptick in velocity and Major League Baseball is looking for all these solutions to help offense, ban the grunt, part two of your story here, that's how to fix offense. Don't let pitchers grunt anymore.
Well, you say funny, but I interviewed a lot of hitters about that very topic. Cause I said, hey, is this, cause I know, well, if I was standing in on, you know, a Max Scherzer pitch, I'd probably be terrified no matter what. But with a grunt, especially, I think that would throw me off. But the majority of hitters said it's not even something they register because of how quickly it's happening, that by the time they're hearing the grunt, it's not impacting how they can make a decision on their swing. So that was a thought I had, and I just had to clear the air that, you know, the sound is traveling too quickly. It's not tipping pitches or anything like that. It's more just seems to be for the crowd to enjoy or whatever they may do with it.
the tipping a pitch aspect would be interesting. Like say, okay, max effort is the only explanation for it, right? And you're a fastball curveball guy and you have to fake grunt on your curveball because the max effort on your fastball like gives it away. It would be funny to play that out. Okay, I want to ask you a couple of real baseball questions now because in addition to this piece you write about, I mean, this is about baseball as well, but you're also down in Boston. What are your thoughts of this Red Sox team overall right now? Obviously, some interesting young pieces locked up under contract in Bayo and Devers. You know, Cass is very young as well. And kind of right on the fringe of this wild card race here heading into September, what do you make of where they're at overall and their chances of maybe closing that gap here in September? Well, sorry, I keep saying here in September. It's August 29th, but you get what
close
I mean.
Enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it seems to change day to day, which maybe isn't the best sign for making the playoffs. But you mentioned all the young guys. I think that's kind of like a strength and weakness for them right now. Like, there's a lot of excitement among the young guys. I think you're also seeing a lot of, especially on the pitching side, you have these young guys who are matching or approaching career highs in innings, and you're seeing it. You know, they're feeling the weight of 162 games right now. So I think there's a lot to be excited about with them. It's just kind of managing that workload, trying to keep guys healthy on the pitching side. That's particularly difficult right now. You just have 2-year trade deadline acquisitions go down. But then on the other hand, you have guys coming back, like Liam Hendricks, hopefully coming back for the White Sox series next week. So, you know, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket and hope that these guys returning are going to be able to get you over. But at the same time, I do think there is a lot, you know, it's kind of a matter of like, if we can just get through these next couple weeks, then hopefully, you know, things might turn for them. A good sign already last night for Brian Bello, who has struggled in the second half. Sorry, I'm realizing as I say that, where this is airing.
No, it's fine. I mean, Papelbon was just on and we were talking about how good Bayo was too. It's fine. We're very aware of what the standings look like here in Toronto right now. We can appreciate a Brian Bello outing.
Oh yeah. Papelbon was before me. Okay. So I can't possibly say anything that way. yeah. I mean, he struggled in the second half and then you have him go out this year or last night and has one of his best outings of his career. So it's kind of a day by day situation. It feels like you have a lot to be excited about. You have these big moments, then you get into these slumps where, you know, just swept by the Diamondbacks. But it's kind of they're three games out. It feels like if you were to say to any Red Sox fan in February, March of this year, that they would be in real contention at the end of August, I think people would have been thrilled. I don't think people would have believed, you know, whoever told them that. So they're in a good position, and I think they're exceeding expectations in a lot of ways, which has kind of now raised the bar for people expecting them to make it to the postseason. So I think they just kind of faced the gauntlet of a schedule, you know, especially on the road. Houston, Baltimore got through that. So I think the schedule eases up a little bit from here. So kind of really anyone's game. But I'd say it's there, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, the idea of Liam Hendricks returning for that White Sox series, the one good thing in the White Sox season is getting to see Liam Hendricks come back and pitch against them would be pretty fitting for them. Okay, so this was a couple weeks ago now, and it's not a Red Sox question, but you wrote about Spencer Arrighetti absolutely torching the Red Sox a couple weeks back. I think he had 13 strikeouts in that game. He had just cooked the Rays before that. He's coming off most recently shutout performances against the Orioles and the Phillies with lots of strikeouts. He has been a confusing guy for me all year because, like, you look at his worst outings this year and it's like Detroit, Toronto, Oakland, the White Sox. And then you look at his best ones, they're like, well, Philly, Baltimore, Boston. Tough one to figure out. What did you make from that start and getting to talk to him a little bit, writing that piece about where this pretty enigmatic young guy is in his first full season?
Yeah, I mean, kind of a different situation, but I've seen similar on the Red Sox side of, you know, playing to competition. Like, that's happened all the time there. So I'm not saying that's what happened there, but I think he's just been tremendous, especially for the position he's in of that rotation, how many injuries they've had and needing guys to step up. And he has done just that. That was one of those outings where on the other side, guys were kind of all they could say was like, I'm going to tip my cap to him. So yeah, for him to string together those outings, I think that's exactly what Houston needs. Like, yes, it's not great that, you know, he wasn't doing well against the teams, you know, below 500, but at the end of the day, the Astros are going to make the postseason as they do every single year. They're going to be playing these better teams. So to have a guy like that who you can count on to really pull through in those situations, give you the innings, striking out guys left and right, that's exactly what they need. So pretty exciting year for him, and I'm sure the Astros are pretty thrilled about what they've gotten from Spencer.
Yeah, and still just 24, so lots of time to figure it out there. Before I let you go,
exactly,
Molly, I would like to go back to 2023, I think, maybe even further back to that. It was, I don't know. So when I'm prepping for a guest, I want to like get to know them a little. So I, you know, scan the Twitter or the Instagram or whatever. And MLB doesn't let us go back through your writer archives properly. So I got to be a little creative in how I find old articles. You went to a Bronson Arroyo concert and you wrote about it. So I'm going back far here. I apologize for that. But this is among the most fascinating assignments I can imagine. As a big music guy, a player turned musician, how was the Bronson Arroyo concert experience? And I mean, I guess just reporting off a concert as well, seemed like a blast.
Incredible. Again, I started this by saying I pitched some weird things in the past, so they weren't too surprised at this. I think Bronson Arroyo concert was up there. That was one of the coolest things I've gotten to do. I spent probably an hour with him at the rehearsal the day before at this little small venue in Boston. And we just sat backstage and talked. And he is one of the most fascinating people I've talked to, not just players, just people. And he's so passionate about it. And to hear like this guy who had so much success in, you know, in the sports world, and then it's just kind of made the decision when he retired, like, okay, I'm actually now going to pivot and be find a lot of success in this other area. He was very passionate, and the concert was pretty incredible. It was at one of my favorite spots in my neighborhood, so it worked out great as a as an assignment. But yeah, just what a fascinating guy. We did not run out of things to talk about. I think when I was transcribing, I have to go back after I finish the, you know, transcribing to see what was the question I even asked, because we got so far down another road. But yeah, definitely one of my coolest assignments.
Well, that sounds like, I mean, I went back and read the piece this morning. It was a lot of fun. It sounds like it was a lot of fun to do. The grunting story was a lot of fun. This is what you do. I love your stuff. Thank you for doing this morning. This was fun.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Molly Burkhart of MLB.com. Again, you can go read that piece on grunts up at MLB.com. And yeah, as much as on the surface it could sound like a silly thing, there is a real reasoning behind it. And if you look at the tennis world, an actual like scientific reasoning behind why our bodies can get a little more out of them at the highest level of performance if we just let a little grunt out. Don't think that applies to radio hosts. If I started grunting on air, I'd probably lose my job pretty quickly. But in other areas of your life, now I'm very curious if like combat sports people do it. I mean, I know in karate, you do the like throaty exhale with each strike. I think in boxing, you're probably too breathing focused to really let it out, but we'll see. I'll deliver a couple blows to Austin Mackey at the break and figure that out. And when we come back, we'll talk to Levi Weaver, who I nearly crossed paths with in New York. We'll also set you up for tonight's game 5 of this series, Cutter Crawford against Bowden Francis. We'll continue to take some of your texts to 590, 590. Standard data and message rates may apply, but you can fire those our way. All that's next in the final segment of Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays wrap it up with the Red Sox tonight. Bowden Francis against Cutter Crawford, 7:10 on Sportsnet. Dan Buck and Hazel, Jamie and Caleb on Blue Jay Central, Ben and Chris on the radio side, and Ben Nicholson-Smith just lives in Boston now, there for the entirety of this set. 3-0 loss last night. This is how you know I'm rusty after 3 days off. I don't think I said the score of the game earlier. I just said that Brian Baio shut him down. 8 shutout innings for Brian Baio, 9 strikeouts, 11 ground ball outs. Pretty impressive stuff. Should also say pretty good stuff from Chris Bassitt as well. He allowed an RBI single from Willy Abreu in the first inning, but that was pretty much it. Stranded the bases loaded in that inning, mostly cruised through from then until the seventh when Brandon Little came in with 2 outs to get Jaren Duran out with 2 on. So yeah, Bassitt ends up with 6 2/3, 1 earned over that stretch with just 6 base runners and tied a season high with 9 strikeouts. Also moved a little bit on the mound toward the third base side, something that the Gate 14 guys picked up early in the start, and then Hazel followed up with on the broadcast. And yeah, after the broadcast, he did move a little bit to the third base side. I'm paraphrasing here, but telling Hazel basically he thinks, teams have started to figure some stuff out. So you got to change it up. You got to get similar to what we were talking about with hitters and constantly changing the hand placement or the bat tilt or the leg kick and things like that. Pitchers also constantly tweaking, and the results were pretty good for Bassitt last night. Didn't get the win. The Jays continue to struggle in Bassitt starts no matter how well he pitches. As our pal Chris Black pointed out earlier, over the last little while, the Jays are 2-10 in the last six starts from Chris Bassitt and Yariel Rodriguez, and they are 15-3 in the game started by Gausman, Berríos, and Francis. That is not all the fault of Bassitt and Rodriguez, or the credit of Gausman, Berríos, and Francis, but Bowden Francis has certainly done his part. I know we've talked a lot of Rich Hill today, but and considering he hasn't pitched in this series yet, but we're going to do a little bit more of it. But first, let's talk to another 44-year-old who is playing a lot of baseball this week. It's Levi Weaver of The Athletic, of the Windup Newsletter, in an Idol shirt. What's up, man? How we doing?
I'm good, man. I heard that we just almost crossed paths this past week. I was in New York, and I feel like we just sort of ships in the night.
We did. Yes, I was there Monday to Wednesday, but I didn't get in until like midday Monday. I was trying to coordinate with our pal Lindsay Adler, but then you were out of there before it worked out. How was so? You were in New York, and this is going to be about you a little bit, so I apologize for that. But a couple of like wood bat sandlot games, New York and Connecticut, three games over 3 days, riding the buses and stuff like that. How was it, man?
Dude, it was so much fun. Like, if any listeners are out there and have not heard about sandlot baseball, basically, like, the skill level is we've got guys that had played in college, you know, two decades ago. We've got people who have never played before. It is, like, fast pitch, wood bat baseball, but it's very cool. There's nobody out there, like, you know, pumping up their chest and, like, arguing balls and strikes. It's basically just like, hey, do you miss playing baseball? We think it's kind of cool too. Come play baseball. So once in a while, we get to take a little trip. Got to play in Connecticut and also upstate New York. And it was a blast. My body's in full revolt. And sure enough, and I get back and it's like, oh, hey, Rich Hill is coming back. He's your same age and he's going to play Major League Baseball. And it was like, man, I feel his pain a little bit. It's not easy out here being 44, trying to like throw a baseball super hard or, you know, steal a base or any of that business.
You also, I believe, you had a bit of a home plate collision.
Yeah, that was the week before in Tulsa. Oh. That was a bad send. That was not my fault. I just, you know, you got to listen to your coaches, and when they do, the send was funny. It was not like this big whirlwind, like go go go. I just look up and the third base coach has a finger pointing at home like this, which radio won't be able to see, but I'm just very casually pointing at home. So yeah, it wasn't so much a collision as it was me just like trying to jump out of the way and then landing on the entire right side of my body. So yeah, I'm happy for a couple weeks off, but yeah, let's, so what's going on? Hey, I have a question for you.
Yeah. What's up?
I know you're the host and you're the one that asks questions, but what's going on with Vlad Guerrero Jr.? Why has he turned into like, he's basically he looks like Aaron Judge in the second half, not quite Aaron Judge, but I mean, he was slugging 826 or something in the second half. What got into him?
Yeah, I think if you look at just the last 30 days too, he's at like a 220 weighted runs created plus. So he is like in Judge territory over the last little bit. Honestly, part of it is like when he was struggling earlier in the year, it's like, oh, it's Vlad. He'll figure it out. And then there was that stretch where he was hitting like almost 400 over like a month with like no power, but he was roping the ball. And it really is like a lot of it feels like, well, hey, all the stuff we kept saying about like, if you hit the ball hard, eventually you're going to get extra base hits and home runs and things like that has come around. You know, I obviously like some of the discipline stuff, like when you see he's still going to expand the zone a little bit, but when he is like spitting on borderline pitches and, you know, not expanding unless he wants to expand, those are always good signs. Probably still, you know, if you look at like the launch angle stuff, he could probably have even more power coming out of this bat if he could figure that out, but he hits everything so hard and, you know, finds enough holes for the singles. And then the power's really come along. It's been cool, man. It's like all fields power, especially the left center to right center. You know, the toughest part to hit balls out. It's been cool. It's been really fun to see. And like, it's crazy to think, and a lot of this has to do with like how the Major League Baseball offensive environment has changed. But when we adjust for like league average and park factors and stuff like that, this is like right on par with his 2021 when he was second in MVP voting to Shohei. Obviously no one's going to vote for him because Judge and Witt are doing what they're doing and the Jays are five games under 500. But it's pretty crazy that he's gotten his full season line like back to that level.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit like the DJ showing up to the party at like 1:30 a.m. and most people have gone home. You're like, that's going to be a great half an hour. where were you at 8 p.m., dude? Like, it's got to be a little frustrating, but man, it's maybe encouraging for next year if he can sort of keep this going into 2025.
Yeah, like you would have loved for him to hit this way in April and, you know, maybe things look a little differently, although I don't think that would have dragged Bo and George Springer and guys like that a little further along. But yeah, I mean, he's going to be coming off arguably certainly his best contact hitting season and best, you know, double season and things like that. I don't know if he's ever going to get 48 home runs again like he did in 2021. But, you know, this is the reason why the Jays are like, yeah, we're not going to blow the entire thing up. We got Vlad for 2025 still. Okay, let's pivot off the Jays. This Red Sox team that they're playing against, hanging on for dear life in the wild card picture. Now, they look like they were really on the fringes. Then they beat the Jays the last two here. What do you make of that American League wild card race? And I guess, you know, we had talked about it being the Royals that they were targeting for so long. It's the Twins now. Three games is pretty close for September, even if it doesn't feel all that close at times for this Red Sox team.
Yeah, man, all year long, the Red Sox have sort of had this feel to me of like, they're done, right? And then you look up and they're like, no, they're two games out, or they're in the last wild card spot. Like, they've just been piecing it together a little bit at a time. And you can't rule them out yet. You're right. Three games is nothing. It's not even September yet, technically. So, you know, Jaron Duran is having a nice second half. Tyler O'Neill, I guess, has not had as many at-bats. He's had a good second half. So, yeah, I mean, I wish that I had a better explanation as to exactly why they're still hanging around. But kudos to them. And I'm honestly super happy to see Rich Hill. I mean, he's from there, and I guess he had some other offers to maybe come back again. And I cannot stress this enough. I mean, basically like Bartolo Colon age. he's gonna be in the middle of a wild card race. So. I think they're going to be interesting enough to cause some disruption or to at least cause a little angst. And frankly, the Twins have kind of not been super great lately. So maybe the Red Sox do sneak in. So I don't think the AL wildcard has been as interesting to me this year as the NL wildcard, but yeah, let's not rule them out. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. And the NL wildcard, I mean, the Mets are on life support too now, four games out. We'll go to the NL side in a little bit here. But yeah, it is the Twins that the Sox are chasing just as much as the Royals here. What have you made of the Royals? Like, I think the Royals have the best record in baseball other than the Diamondbacks in the second half here. And they're playing like 600 plus ball over the last month. Obviously a lot of this is Bobby Witt Jr., but it's not just Bobby Witt Jr., right?
Right, yeah. I mean, you've got your usual suspects. You've got Salvador Perez is looking, you know, like one of the best offensive catchers in the league. And then their pitching has been really good. I mean, they made so many moves this offseason, and it kind of felt a little bit like they were going quantity over quality. They're just, you know, signing some veteran guys, kind of – basically trying to rebuild in 1 year, and they lost, what was it, like 106 games or something last year.
Yeah.
Like, they were terrible last year. If they had beaten the Guardians last night, they would be in sole possession of first place in the AL Central. That is a remarkable turnaround. And their pitching staff has been very good with these veteran guys they've got, with Lugo and Waka. So Cole Reagans is another guy that has been, you know, listen, flags fly forever in Texas, but that has to sting for them to have lost him for, you know, half a year of Aroldis Chapman. So they've got some guys that are just finally putting it together. The guys that are supposed to contribute are contributing. Vinny Pasquantino's hit something like 10 or 11 home runs since the All-Star break. They're a good team. They're actually pretty good. You start to really break it down and look at the various components, and it's like, yeah, this does not seem to be a fluke. They are... Now, are they a 600 team? No, probably not, but they're good. And with the Guardians struggling in the second half, I would not at all be surprised to see the Royals end up taking the AL Central, which would be such a remarkable turnaround from 1 year ago.
Yeah, it's. I think they only have to go around 500 the rest of the way for it to be the biggest turnaround for a 100-loss team in the history of baseball. And there have been a lot of 100-loss teams, sadly, in the history of baseball. There's one even in that division already, even though we got a month of baseball. left. When it comes to the American League playoff races, Levi, look, it feels like it's down to just that one race. The Red Sox chase, obviously the AL Central division crown, the AL East division crown are both open, but it does feel like, you know, hey, six of the playoff teams are going to come from this group of seven, even though the Mariners are only technically 3.5 back of the division and 4.5 back of the wild card. Are you surprised that the AL West teams kind of went as quietly as they did once the Astros got hot? We may have lost Levi. All right, we will try to reconnect with Levi here in a minute. While we wait for that, we will, again, we'll take some of your texts to 590-590. We can take a look at it's Cutter Crawford against Bowden Francis tonight. Bowden Francis obviously coming off of the best three-game stretch of his career. The best three-game stretch, if we use Baseball Reference's game score, which takes every start in baseball and scores it from 0 to 100, where 50 is the league average start, this is the best three-game stretch by a Blue Jays starter since Roy Halladay, which is anytime that happens, that is that's pretty incredible. His ERA on the season, Bowden Francis, is now down to 4.02. So even with that really bad start, the shaky first outing when he came back up and had to come out of the bullpen in the kind of botched opener day, he's managed to get that season-long number down to 4.02, and that's over 70-plus innings. And you look at some of the underlying metrics, and they say he could have been even better. He's got a 3.78 expected ERA. All of this despite the fact that, you know, he doesn't get a ton of chase outside of the zone. He doesn't get a ton of swing and miss. He's just solid across the board, solid to above average, quality of contact metrics, hard hit rate, strikeout rate, doesn't walk a lot of guys. Just really solid across the board when you look at the season-long numbers now. And then obviously over this last little bit, really, really impressive stuff. We'll continue to set you up for that one in a minute. We do have Levi Weaver of The Athletic back on here. Levi, before we lost you there, I was asking you, setting up that, hey, the Seattle Mariners are technically in this race as well, both for the wild card and the AL West, although it feels like they're kind of on the periphery of it. Are you surprised at all that once the Astros kind of got hot, the rest of the AL West went as quietly as it did?
I am, based on what I thought about the teams coming into this year. I thought the Mariners were actually going to be really good. I mean, the rotation being as good as it is, they've got some guys on the team that can, I mean, for goodness sake, Julio Rodriguez, it should be incredible, right? Cal Raleigh should be incredible. But I'm not, and the Rangers won the World Series last year. I'm not as surprised based on what I saw from the Mariners and Rangers for the first half of the season. It was like that entire division was just sort of splashing around in the shallow end of the swimming pool. And then the Astros stood up and were like, okay, boys, time for the cannonball. And so, yeah, the Mariners and Rangers kind of just continued to do what they've done all year, which is suck. And so I'm not surprised that once a team got hot, the rest of the teams sort of just, waved them on, like, you go on without us. Coming into the season, I definitely expected the Mariners and Rangers both to really contend with the Astros to take the division crown, and it just absolutely has not happened.
Yeah, we kind of thought it would be as competitive as the NL West, right? Where, the Dodgers have managed to hold the Padres and Diamondbacks at arm's length, but it really does feel like all three of those teams, and this is a hard pivot to National League conversation now, are you a believer in all three of those teams? Like it feels like the NL playoff, even though the playoff race itself is no longer, the Mets are four games out. It's on their last breaths here a little bit. But the actual good teams in the NL are really, really good, and we're headed for a pretty good playoff bracket here.
Yeah, and I mean, the Dodgers, if they're holding the Padres and Diamondbacks at arm's length, it's a very short arm.
Yeah.
Because that's the division we expected to not be competitive this year, right? The Dodgers spent like $1 billion in free agency. I expected them to win that division by like 15 to 20 games. That absolutely has not happened. So, yeah, I mean, I was watching Diamondbacks Mets last night, and the D-backs made a kind of boneheaded play at the plate. Didn't really, there's a run, the go-ahead run scored on a pretty laissez-faire tag attempt. And I was like, man, that just does not look like the Diamondbacks. And then here comes Corbin Carroll with a go-ahead grand slam later in the game. They've looked so good in the second half. The Padres are kind of an enigma. Like, it seems like they're always exciting and fun, and then they maybe almost like Mariners NL, that they find a way to disappoint people at the very end. But I think that both of those teams are better than I expected. And especially after trading Juan Soto, they've come back and just put together a team that looks pretty good. I mean, Jurickson Profar is having a great year. He's going to get some down ballot MVP votes. Yeah, the NL bracket should be a lot of fun this year.
Yeah, it should be. And it was obviously a lot of fun, that the Dodgers game last night with Decoy throwing out the first pitch. Mm-hmm. And man, 8 hours early, people lining up for bobbleheads.
That's crazy, right? And then, like, I saw the they had some of these inserts with the gold bobbleheads. And I think it was Molly Knight pointed out, she's like, this looks like young Bill Clinton more than it looks like.
Oh, it really does.
It kind of does. But yeah, I mean, baseball is such a long season. And, you know, it's not just the 162. It's also 6 weeks of spring training. It's also like a month of postseason. It's such a long slog. And especially in August, it can get so tedious, right? Like, you're just like, yeah, we get it. Let's get to mid-September so we can sort out these playoff races. Moments like last night where, you know, Shohei Ohtani is this mysterious figure. He's the biggest star in baseball. He is one of the biggest global superstars in all of sports. And it's like, we hear about this dog named Decoy, and it's like, oh, that's cool. We get to see some of his personal life. And then here they are, you know, the dog brings in the ball for first pitch. Apparently Ohtani spent like 6 weeks training him to do that. He gets a little high five at the end. It was cool. It was a cool little moment. And all of baseball is like, who cares about ERAs and BABIP? Like, look at Decoy. He just brought the ball to home plate. This is awesome.
And then Ohtani's like, oh, I'll hit a home run and steal base two, and now I'm 42-42, and I'm on pace to be the first 50-50 guy of all time. It's pretty ridiculous. Levi, I imagine the Windup newsletter is going to do a lot of this over the last month because, you know, as playoff races sort of, I mean, it's kind of, I'd imagine it's like, hey, we're going to check on the playoff races, and within a couple weeks here, start checking in more regularly on the award races. Is this about the time you start looking at that stuff, or is that stuff on you? Like you mentioned, potential down ballot MVP votes a second ago there. Do you start looking at this stuff now?
A little bit. So my vote this year, I have an AL MVP vote, and the Baseball Writers Association is very like, they get very frowny if you start talking about who you're going to vote for ahead of time. they kind of want it to be a surprise. What I do on that is like, you know, keep an eye on it, but I'll probably do some writing about the other awards. And then the AL MVP is one of those that I just try to dedicate a day to go through at the end of the season and like, okay, let's really, now that we've got the full picture, look at the final stat line. Cause that sort of thing can change pretty quickly. Unless there's just a very, very clear favorite. I hope I'm not giving away too much on my end on that one. So it's about that time to start looking. You know, Tarek Skubal, I think, is probably your Cy Young winner in the American League. AL Rookie of the Year should be interesting. We sort of all expected at the beginning of the year, like, okay, it's probably going to be either Jackson Holliday or Wyatt Langford. It's not going to be either of those guys. That's going to be a fun one to see how that shakes out. Yeah, and the NL Rookie of the Year, I mean, Jackson Merrill's really made some strides recently, especially with his clutch home runs. How much do we weigh Shota Imanaga's previous, Ichiro won Rookie of the Year when he was clearly a veteran in Japan. So how much do we weigh that? So we got some good races. The one I'm the most interested in, and, you know, I've written about this, Ken has written about this, like, for NL MVP, you know, a couple of years ago, it was very easy to look at Shohei Ohtani and go, well, you know, if somebody else is having a comparable year, really all you have to look at is like, well, how many innings did that other guy pitch?
Zero.
Right? None. So the value that he provides on the mound is a huge boost to vote for him. Well, he's a designated hitter this year. He hasn't played any defense. Are we going to see a designated hitter win most valuable player? Like, is he that much better than every other player where you can just go, yeah, the other player's offense plus defense does not equal what Ohtani has done at the plate. And frankly, I kind of think I don't have a vote, so I can say, like, I think he's probably the favorite to win the MVP as a designated hitter this year.
Yeah, and he'd be the first one who, like you said, didn't pitch to win it. And I think, you know, obviously designated hitter, you're only contributing with the bat, but I think something that does help is that he's also, like, even by the statistical metrics, not just the stolen bases, he's been what, the third most valuable base runner in the entire National League after Corbin Carroll and Ellie De La Cruz. So you at least get that. Like, I think, like, David Ortiz couldn't win the MVP despite finishing in everyone's top five all the time, in part because he was also a huge negative on the base paths. But Shohei is going to steal 50 bases. That's a fascinating, it's a fascinating one. You mentioned the slog of August a little earlier, and from a news perspective, things like, hey, Jason Hayward signed with the Astros, Elias Diaz, who was bizarrely, you know, cut, signs with the Padres, things like that. Do you like that wrinkle of like, hey, there's a trade deadline, but as long as you clear waivers by August 31st, or sorry, as long as you're on in the organization by September 1st, you can be playoff eligible. Like, do you like that? Do we need to get rid of it entirely or go back to the post, the former, you know, post-trade deadline waiver trade? Like, what do you make of this new environment where, you know, you can't trade, but guys are still getting waived and signed with playoff eligibility?
This might be just my cynical old man boredom talking, but like the highlight of my week was a dog running a ball to home plate. I like any wrinkle in August. If there's something that's even slightly interesting, I'm in. So, you know, is it better than the old waiver trade deadline? I don't know. I really don't know which one is better. I do think it does make, I feel like baseball media as a whole has not really, we pump up the trade deadline. People love to read about that. We will write about that until our eyes bleed. We don't really write a whole lot about these, but like, will Jason Hayward be a contributor to the Astros? The Astros outfield has been terrible. Mm-hmm. So bringing in Jason Hayward, like, he's not, it's not like they're bringing in Juan Soto or anything, but he's going to contribute on that team, and they have a reasonably good chance to go to the World Series again this year. So it is interesting. It is very impactful. And I do think it's, you know, from an interest standpoint, I'm very interested in it. Lord knows what the Rockies are ever doing. They should have traded Elias Diaz this year. I don't know why they didn't. I heard that there was not really the interest level that they wanted. Well, you know, you probably could have got a low A pitcher for him. And
literally anything.
Literally anything. And they just were like, no, we're gonna do it the weirdest way possible. So it's interesting. Would it be more interesting if we had the waiver trades still available? Maybe, but it's at least something. It's something to keep me occupied until we get to the like last couple weeks of the season and we can really start honing in on these last final few playoff spots.
Yeah, it's moderately of interest. You know, Michael Tonkin, Jason Hayward. Sure, we'll see who hits the waiver wire today as well. Levi, thanks so much for taking the time out today, man. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
Levi Weaver of The Athletic, the wind-up newsletter in your inbox every morning if you subscribe to that. A lot of great stuff from Levi and Ken Rosenthal in that, in addition to links to all over The Athletic. Jays back in business tonight. Cutter Crawford against Bowden Francis. Talked a little bit about Bowden Francis's strong play of late while we were waiting to reconnect with Levi there. He has faced the Red Sox three times. Two-thirds of an inning as a reliever in April 2022, one inning as a reliever in August 2023, and one inning as a reliever in June 2024. So the remaining Red Sox who are active only have five plate appearances against them. They went 1-for-5 with a single. So not a lot to go off of there. Of course, the splitter usage increasing, especially against lefties, has been the story of Bowden Francis this season. This is a Red Sox team that has not done particularly well against splitters from righties. One of the worst outcomes in the league as far as run value goes. They're fourth worst against righty splitters, but you never know. And then obviously the other component of Bowden Francis's splitter improving so much is that it has helped the fastball play up because those pitches play off of each other so well. The results on his fastball have been tremendous since he started introducing the splitter more, even though that's, you know, 93, 94 more often than not. On the other side, Cutter Crawford, We're kind of an odd profile. Gets a ton of chase outside of the zone, but doesn't get a lot of swing and miss. Pretty average strikeout rate. Very low barrel rate, which means, you know, our guys squaring it up. So they make contact even when they're chasing outside the zone, but they don't barrel it up that much. Only two other pitchers in baseball allow more infield pop-ups than Cutter Crawford. So you're thinking, hey, he's doing something well with that. That's a, you know, a lot of weak contact, a lot of unthreatening contact. But he's also tied for first in Major League Baseball in home runs allowed. So he's living on the edge there a little bit. He's got a 4.19 ERA. The underlying metrics agree, hey, he's about a 4 ERA pitcher. Neutral-ish splits, but 17 of those 28 home runs have come against lefties, so I'd expect the Jays to go lefty-heavy as they have been against righties. His only appearances against the Jays, similar to what I was saying with Bound Freds, is he had the 1 1/3 inning before the game got suspended earlier this year and 1 1/3 when he was a reliever last May, so nothing too useful there. Springer's 4-for-10 against him with a home run, and Vlad is 4-for-9 with a walk. So a little bit of information there. Yeah, we'll see how this one goes. It should be fun. I'm going to save some of the texts that we had in the text line for tomorrow. You can always text those into 590, 590. We bank them for, we'll do a bunch more tomorrow. So apologies to Lee and Nick that I didn't get to theirs today, but I will sprinkle them in tomorrow, I promise. A thank you to Ben Shulman, Jonathan Papelbon, Molly Burkhart, and Levi Weaver for joining us today. To Show Ali and Nick Ashbourne for filling in the last 3 days on the show, and to Austin Mackey, who I didn't actually punch during the break, by the way, to figure out if you grunt about boxing. I should clarify that I'm not out here abusing our technical producers, Amit Mann and Jennifer Rolnick, as well. The Jays get going against the Twins tomorrow. So in addition to Bowden Francis against Cutter Crawford tonight, we'll break that one down tomorrow. We will set up that Twins series that the Twins will need pretty badly because the Red Sox are right on their tail for that final wildcard spot, and the Royals have jumped them in the AL Central. Big couple days ahead. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a wonderful Thursday.